Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist. I'm Lynn Pavelski, a member here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and a open-minded congregation. We welcome people of all ethnic and religious backgrounds, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, abilities, or inabilities. Today, Mary Mullen, one of our Prairie members, will be presenting the program. Now we're going to invite all the children and parents to the front of the room for our children's story. Today's story is going to be shared by Mary Mullen.
Well, how many of you kids know that today is Mother's Day? Everybody? Good. It's a day that we honor our mothers, and they can be mothers or grandmothers or, you know, any women who have provided that kind of service, like a mother. Could even be a babysitter. So the story I want to tell you today is about my grandmother. My grandma lived on a dairy farm near Seymour, Wisconsin. That's up near Green Bay. Everybody knows where Green Bay is, right? And it's a story about her favorite song. The song that Mechie and Ann and I sang at the beginning was my grandma's favorite song. My grandma lived in a really small house that she and her husband, who was a farmer too, built new when they were ready to retire from farming. And it was so small that when you came in the door and you went through the kitchen to the living room, you could just barely squeeze between the stove and the table. It was just a really small room. And then when you got into the living room and you looked to the left, you saw my grandma's favorite possession. It was her player piano. Does anyone know what a player piano is? Will you pump it? Okay, here's a picture. This is very much like my grandma's player piano looked. And you see there's a little space up here, kind of like on here. And then there would be rolls of paper that would go like this. And you'd pump. Let's see, I'll show you a pumping area. You put your feet on these and you'd pump up and down, and that would make the roll go around. And there were these little holes in the paper, and it would play the piano automatically. It was really fun to do. So, anyway, it was really fun to play this, and we always begged to go and play the player piano when we went to see my grandma. And one time I was pumping the player piano, and my grandma said to me, that's my favorite song. Well, I was playing the song Juanita that we sang a little bit earlier. And the words you might remember are, Nita, Juanita, ask thy soul if we should part. It's a very sad song. And of course, the piano didn't say the words, but I think my grandma sang along when she told me that was her favorite song. She had a very low voice, kind of like Ann's, the tenor. And maybe the words were even printed on the piano roll like they are in this one picture here. This is the king in his counting house, and you can see the words are right along here. Okay. Now, I think I was the only kid who remembered that this was my grandma's favorite song. So the next part of the story is how I found out who wrote that song. It started when my youngest sister wanted, I told her this was my grandma's favorite song, and she had never heard that it was. And she said, well, tell me more about this song, you know, where it came from. And I didn't know. So now, if you didn't know that and somebody asked you to say, find out who wrote a song, how would you find out?
Your grandma.
Ask my grandma. I would, but she was not alive anymore.
Go on the computer.
Do what? Go on the computer. That's exactly what I did. I went to the internet. But it was very frustrating, because what happened when I went to the computer is it took me to Jim Reeves, a country singer, singing this song in the early 1960s, and it said that he wrote that song. Well, my grandmother was already dead, so I knew he did not write that song. So then I looked on the computer some more, and then I found that it was in a list of songs from the Civil War. That was in the 1800s, more than 100 years ago, 150 years ago. But it said, guess who it said wrote it? Anonymous. Now, can you say that word, anonymous?
Anonymous.
Anonymous. Do any of you know what anonymous means? What's it mean?
It means things that you don't want people to know your name.
You know, you're absolutely right. Because anonymous usually means a woman wrote it. And back in, you know, the early 1800s and before that, women weren't supposed to, they're only supposed to be in the home. They're not supposed to be writing songs. They're not supposed to be drawing attention to themselves in the public. So I didn't really think of that at the time, but anonymous. So I was really feeling bad about that. And then I remembered, oh, you know, I have some old books. And maybe they have books from the Civil War. So take a look at this book. See where the tab is? Let's see. And go to where the tab is. Do you see that song there, Juanita? Okay. And it tells you who wrote it. Juanita, right here. Let me read it to you because it's kind of hard words. Juanita, for many years a favorite, was written by the granddaughter of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, the Irish wit and playwright. Okay, he's the one that wrote School for Scandal, for those of you who studied that sort of thing. The Honorable Mrs. Norton, as she was called, adapted her text to an old Spanish air and rearranged it much in its present form. Oh, so now I could go to the internet and find out who she was. Wow. Hundreds of things on the internet. She wrote many, many poems. She wrote many songs. She wrote novels. And I found out lots more about her. I found out that she was a very famous mother who had had a husband who was very mean to her. And she didn't want to live with him anymore, but the laws in England said that the kids belong to the father only. And so he just took them away. And she couldn't see them. She didn't see them for about 6 years. She had three little boys. But she was not going to stand for this, so she helped change the laws of England so that mothers could keep their children until they were 7 years old, and then they could have access to them. They could visit them if the father decided he wanted them after that. So now as you leave to go downstairs, don't leave just yet, I want you to remember three things. Sometimes you might find out what your grandma's favorite song is, and you might want to know a little bit more about the song. And second, when you see anonymous, it might mean that a woman wrote the song. And third, there are laws that women have worked for to protect women and kids.
Our speaker this morning is Mary Mullen. Mary is a longtime member of Prairie and is currently a member of the program committee. She's a former high school and elementary teacher and likes to, as you saw earlier, likes to share her discoveries with anyone who will listen. So thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Well, I don't have quite enough time to tell you everything that I found out, but I'd like you first of all to look at that set of pictures that there. Those are all mostly paintings of Caroline Norton, who we're talking about, and there's a sheet coming around of pictures. I don't know if it was clear, but she was a woman who was in England, not in the United States. And as I told the children, I discovered her by chance. And you might say that because of my search for more information, I really opened a Pandora's box. And the discovery was all the more poignant because at first, I couldn't even find who wrote this song, Juanita, that was written by her. What I told the kids was just the tip of the iceberg of what I learned about her. She was otherwise known as the Honorable Mrs. Norton, or the wife of George Norton. To get the flavor of the story and how it happened, I want you to try to put yourself back into the early 1800s. Caroline Norton was born in 1808. She was a child and a young adolescent during the teens and 1820s, and she married at age 19 to a man who was 7 years older than she. And by the time she was 25, she had three boys. This was at the time of early settlement of Wisconsin, so that kind of sets it in a historic context. These are the times that are depicted in the popular TV series like Upstairs, Downstairs, or Downton Abbey. You can remember the flowing dresses and the huge estates, the parties, the plight of the young woman or young man of a noble class who didn't have enough money. The issues of an older daughter who should marry before the next one marries, and the younger daughter that's waiting for the older one to get married, and the part that servants can play in the relationships between the principals, you know, the upstairs people. Caroline was part of the upstairs people, but she was poor. I've posted those paintings and a photo. There's one photo of her, the one in the lower left, I believe. And then the one that's on the right on the bottom is not really a picture of her. It's a Coca-Cola ad, and it's a picture of Juanita, so to speak. Okay. Well, to understand her personal story, it's also important to know the backgrounds of her family and her husband's family. His family was on the Tory side, and you might compare it to the Republicans of today. And by contrast, her family were dyed-in-the-wool radical Whigs from the time of her grandfather, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, and he was the playwright who wrote School for Scandal, as I mentioned. So think of liberals and Democrats and think of people who are, you know, just on their side. Well, her grandfather Sheridan was more than a playwright. Soon after his popular play was produced, he had met Charles Fox, who was a leader of the radical Whigs, and he gave up writing to go into politics. He became a member of the House of Commons, and he held some other government posts depending on whether the elections brought in the Tories or the Whigs. But no matter what, he kept his radical beliefs. For example, he supported the resistance of the American colonists. That would kind of make people in England think something of him, against him maybe. He defended the French Revolution. He was a strong supporter of the free press, and he opposed the act of union with Ireland. He also had the reputation for being one of the finest orators in Britain. And his strong beliefs were passed down to his daughter, or his granddaughter Caroline, as were all of his literary talents. So no wonder she clashed with the Tory sensibilities of her husband. There was still another factor that you might say set Caroline and her husband apart. It was their personalities and how they were brought up. The Sheridans were a really fun-loving and talented family. Caroline was the third child in a family of seven. And the children were all described as extraordinarily good-looking, with dark hair and splendid eyes. Caroline's eyes were black, just like I pointed out, you know, Destiny, I think, would be like a young Caroline. And it's reported that when her grandfather saw her when she was just a young child, maybe a baby, he commented that he wouldn't want to meet her in a dark woods. Well, the Sheridan children were all nurtured to sing, dance, draw, you know, have all these abilities. And they were a really tight-knit family, probably the more so because their father had died when Caroline was just nine and there were four younger children after her. When Caroline was 11, the kids received a book about an illustrated dandy book. You know, the men, well, often the men dressed as dandies, you know, very fancy ruffles and all sorts of things. And this book, The Dandies, showed the dandies of the day and made fun of them. And so Caroline and her older sister, who was just a year or two older, Helen, did their own book with sketches and rhymes. And one of their friends in publishing saw it and published 50 copies of this book that she and her sister had written when she was 11. And when she was a young girl, Caroline had watched her Uncle Charles Sheridan working on translating poetry, and she was so inspired that in a letter to a friend later on, she said, "I invariably left his study with an enthusiastic determination to write a long poem of my own." And she did this as an adult. She wrote many long poems. Well, these kids also put on what were called private theatricals almost every Sunday. They had a sense of fun and irreverence. And of all the Sheridans, Caroline was the most outspoken and direct, and that was not really expected or even favored in a girl or a young woman. In fact, it suggested that the reason Caroline was the only kid to be sent away to school rather than being learning at home was to tame her wildness. One source I read compared Caroline to one of the heroines of her writing. She wrote novels also. She was compared to Beatrice from, from her novel Lost and Saved, and I've asked Barb Park to read this description to show just how passionately Caroline wrote, as well as to show you what Caroline was like.
She was quick, ardent, and sensitive, capable of all sacrifice for those she loved, capable of all energy for that which she desired to attain, full of eagerness, full of enthusiasm, pitiful and tender. Something of a rarer earnestness was in her than in others, and warmed you while she spoke like a flame. It is in vain to argue that matter. There is as much difference in sensation in different persons as there is difference in their physical strength or intellectual capacities. Beatrice enjoyed more, she suffered more, she felt more than a great proportion of her fellow creatures. Life thrilled through her, as you may see it thrill in the delight of sunshine through a butterfly's closed wings. And to such as she, in whom the visible world and the life of sensation predominate, the temptations of this world are most powerful. Her heart ached. The tears rushed to her eyes at some touching picture or some mournful song. The breath of a warm spring day, the scent of flowers, the purple of the distant hills, the freshness of the waves dashing upon the shore filled her with a vague yearning.
Well, her biographers described Caroline as just the opposite of her dull husband, George. They just weren't fit for each other. A 1909 biography by Jane Grey Perkins describes the pair in this way, and I've asked Kate Lou to read that.
Perhaps in any ordinary case, she would have been right, but certainly no two people were less fitted for each other for all time than Caroline Sheridan and George Norton. Indeed, it seemed as if all the differences of two opposing races and temperaments, the inherent misunderstanding of the Celt and the Saxon, lay between them and held them apart from any real union. She, gifted, impetuous, stormy-tempered, with a reckless, specious tongue, with an instinct for taking the lead and getting possession of everything around her, magnanimous and generous, incapable of hoarding injuries and paying back old scores when once the first ungovernable outburst of resentment against them had subsided. And he, that dangerous mixture which is often found in dull natures, weak but excessively obstinate and suspicious when he thought he was being led, narrow-spirited, intolerant, slow-witted, yet not silent, rather with a certain power of nagging comment for everything about him that he was least able to understand, not without surface kindness and humanity, fond of children and animals, but coarse-natured and self-indulgent, with a capacity for cruelty and brutality and slow revenge, when once convinced he had been aggrieved, so unlike any quality possessed by his wife, that it seemed to confuse and stun her like a blow when she found herself opposed to it. Indeed, it actually did at times take the form of a blow.
Well, you may wonder how these two very different people got together. Well, George became aware of Caroline when she was just 16. Her governess at that school that she was attending brought her to the Grantley estate, which was the estate in the area. And his eccentric sister, Augusta, took notice of her talents in writing and singing and encouraged her. So I suppose that's how George came to notice Caroline. After George and Caroline were married, Augusta and Caroline was one of Caroline's worst enemies. And Caroline detested her as well, being embarrassed by the fact that Augusta dressed in men's clothes and just, you know, wasn't the fancy woman of the day like she was. Although he was 7 years older than she, he wanted to marry her, you know, even though they hadn't really talked or become friends or anything. And her mother said that at 16 she was too young and she needed to finish school and so on, and Caroline no doubt agreed. Her mother said that George would have to wait, and he said he would. So although it was known that the Sheridan family didn't have any money, the father had died, you know, and they didn't have any means of support, the Sheridan girls were really sought after because of their looks and because of all their talents. At this time in England, you know, the oldest girl had to marry first, and then the next one, and then the next one. And there were also coming out parties, so when it was time for the girl to be marriageable, there was the coming out party to present her to society, and the parents hoped that she would find a good match in a rush so that the next girl could come along and get married too. So anyway, Helen was the first in line, and she got married, and then it was Caroline's turn, and she had to get married too because she had a younger sister who was a beauty, and everyone would want to marry her. Not that all of them weren't beautiful. So anyway, when she was 19, her mother urged her to marry George Norton, even though she was not in love with him and hardly knew him. And perhaps Caroline and her mother thought she would get to love George Norton. And her sister Helen said, well, you know, I married a man who I didn't love when I first knew him, but now we're very much in love. And so she encouraged her. And so they were married, and it was a huge, huge mistake. And it wasn't only a mistake because of all the reasons I've mentioned, it was a mistake because George's family had far less money than he had told them. So then they would have money woes on top of it, and you know how that can affect a marriage. So then the soap opera of their life began, and it's really a tale of abuse and how Caroline responded to it. And her response was personal. She didn't have a theory about how women should be equal with men or anything like that. She thought women should be protected by men because that was the belief of the day. But in the process of trying to right the wrongs that had been done to her and going to the law and getting the laws changed, she made life better for mothers and for women altogether. Well, they got married in 1827. And that's when Caroline found out how abusive her husband could be. And she gave an account of how, you know, just in the first few months of marriage, she was attacked physically by her husband. And you'll see that her sharp tongue did not help matters at all. So, Lynn?
We had been married about 2 months when one evening, after we had all withdrawn to our apartments, we were discussing some opinion Mr. Norton had expressed. I said that I thought I had never heard so silly or ridiculous a conclusion. This remark was punished by a sudden and violent kick. The blow reached my side. It caused great pain for several days, and being afraid to remain with him, I sat up the whole night in another apartment. 4 or 5 months afterward, when we were settled in London, we had returned home from a ball. I had then no personal dispute with Mr. Norton, but he indulged in bitter and coarse remarks respecting a young relative of mine who, though married, continued to dance, a practice, Mr. Norton said, no husband ought to permit. I defended the lady spoken of when he suddenly sprang from the bed, seized me by the nape of the neck, and dashed me down on the floor. The sound of my fall woke my sister and brother-in-law, who slept in a room below, and they ran up to the door. Mr. Norton locked it and stood over me, declaring no one should enter. I could not speak. I only moaned. My brother-in-law burst the door open and carried me downstairs. I had a swelling on my head for many days afterwards.
Well, this abuse persisted and was worse when he was drinking, with some better times in between, but Caroline complained to her family about this. I mean, as obviously you probably would, although many abused people, women, don't complain to anyone, they keep it secret. And when George suspected she was writing a complaining letter one time, he said, I can tell by the look on your face. He ripped up her letter. And then she, being like she was, stubbornly started another one. And so then he grabbed her stationery and burned it all in front of her. And there were many, many occasions like this. Well, nevertheless, the couple stayed together. They had these three boys. And by the way, on that timeline, her first boy was born in 1829, not 1827. She temporarily left home in 1835, and her friends and family urged her to stay apart because they knew the story. But George wrote begging letters to her and promised that he wouldn't abuse her anymore. And so she returned to him. And this would be a typical pattern for an abused woman, especially when they have children that they want to stay with and protect. And so Caroline, like many abused women, also wanted to believe that what he said he meant, and that he wouldn't abuse her anymore. Well, all the while this was going on, Caroline was also taking her place in the literary and social society of London. She attended parties and balls. She had salons in her home. She attended those of others. She was the life of the party with all her talents. She could sing. She wrote poetry and so on. And she was an excellent conversationalist. And people just loved to have her there. She was very bold in her remarks, and that's part of why she was the life of the party, I think. She also came in contact with people from government, high up in government, and in literary circles through her social life. And George was not really a part of this. He didn't really approve of it, I think, because he was so different. Well, one friend she made was the experienced politician Lord Melbourne. He became a prime minister. He may have been prime minister more than once. And he was later the favorite advisor to young Queen Elizabeth, who was crowned in 1838, I believe.
Victoria.
Okay, sorry. Victoria is correct. She met Melbourne because her husband George had lost his seat in one of the elections when the Whigs came to power. He was a Tory. And he was out of a job, and you know they didn't have money to start with, not much money. So George asked his wife to see if she could use her political connections to get him a job, and she sent out a bunch of letters, and one of them was to Lord Melbourne, and Lord Melbourne responded and got her husband a job for £1,000 a year, which is a fair amount of money then. And then he got to know Caroline, and this was a beginning of a very intimate friendship between the two that George seemed to condone. After all, he had gotten this big job. And sometimes Melbourne would stop after being in the House of Commons when he was going home. He would stop at Caroline's house almost every day. They would have conversations. Sometimes the family would be there and others. Sometimes it would be with Caroline alone. And sometimes she went to his quarters, and her husband walked her over there and so on, so everything seemed to be fine. And then, besides her social activities, Caroline began writing and selling her work early in marriage. She needed money to support the family, and of course she wanted to write poetry, you heard that earlier, and with the income from her first poetry collection, she bought a piano for herself and also paid for her first confinement when she had her first child. And I think her writing also probably gave her relief from her marriage, which was not good. The timeline gives some of those publications, but by no means all. She's known best for her political pamphlets now, not for her poetry or her songs or her two plays or her novels. And her writing continued throughout her lifetime. All her political writing was done after she separated from her husband in 1836. And the ones that are most prominent are the ones about custody for mothers, custody for kids with their mothers, and also the economic rights of married and divorced women. In her time, when a woman married, all of her income, all of her personal property, any land she owned, or real estate belonged to her husband the minute she got married. The kids also belonged to the husband, so that if there were a separation, if the husband didn't want to let his wife, ex-wife, or separated wife have the children, too bad. He just got them. That's just the way the laws were. Everything belonged to him. By contrast, if you were an unmarried woman and you had illegitimate children, or you were just a single woman, you owned property, you had all the power. You know, didn't have to share it. Well, as I've pointed out, Caroline and George's marriage foundered because of his abusive ways. And although there was never a divorce, I would characterize their relationship after 1836 as being the dirtiest of dirty divorces. Divorces in England that at that time required an actual act of Parliament. and only the husband could ask for one. A woman could get an ecclesiastical divorce, which is really only a separation. You know, if she acquired a divorce in that way, she was still married to him, all her property and everything still belonged to him. She was just separated from him. In 1835, Caroline had left her husband for a little while and then went back. Then in 1836, it was around Easter, and she'd made plans with her other siblings to go to her brother's house and take the kids. But George wasn't invited because by this time he was persona non grata, you might say, with her family. And George's sister and some of his relatives were always stirring him up against her. And so he said, "These kids are not going. You're not going." And she said, "Well, I'm going." And they already had the luggage packed in the carriage for the next morning. And he said, "Unpack it all." So he had the servants unpack it all. And so things were not good. The next morning, she got up early and went over to her sister's, not too far away, to talk about, "Well, what should I do about this?" And while she was out of the house, he packed everything up and took the kids away. And that was about the last time she saw them for 6 years, except for maybe half an hour a year. And once at Christmas time, she saw them for several days, but she couldn't keep them overnight in her place. That's just the kind of a guy who was. And then he started to look at ways to get back at Caroline. And so he kind of sent people out to see, you know, is she having an affair with someone else? Couldn't find any evidence of anything like that. So then he lit on Lord Melbourne, who was her good friend, and he decided he'd try to have a suit against him, and also that would also bring more money because, you know, you would sue somebody and get the man in question and get a lot of money, and so he was hoping to get a lot of money that way too. And at that time, it was only a matter between the two men. The woman had, you know, she couldn't even defend herself and say this didn't happen. Well, so the trial happened. This was just a few months after they separated. It was a 9-day trial, and it was such a travesty that the jury that heard it said that they did not even want to hear the defense of Lord Melbourne, because this was such a crazy, the people that were presented as witnesses were like a drunken coachman and, you know, somebody who, a servant who had been paid to say something. That's what they assumed. They didn't even leave the jury box, and they found that this suit had no meaning. And so Lord Melbourne was, exonerated, but of course she had lost her reputation. And from then on, Caroline, well, she was devastated, and she tried for months and years to get her boys back, or at least to get to see them, and finally she realized there was just no way. The laws were just set against her, and so she used her literary talents and all her political connections and eventually got the law changed. So I'd like Kathy Converse to read some of her writing here about the infant custody. What she wanted to do is have mothers have custody of their kids until they were age 7, and then after that have access to them. She did get that law changed. This, just to give you a flavor of this 125-page long tract that she wrote, Kathy's going to read a little bit. There were 6 different arguments that the opposition was using. And one of them was that if you pass this law, it would give women women access to their kids. It would render reconciliations impossible between the husband and the wife. So,
this objection is founded on the notion that if a woman could see her children without returning to her husband, it would not be worth her while to return. But this is an argument based on very false notions of the degree and strength of a mother's love. To be allowed to see a little child occasionally and be satisfied that it was apparently doing well might satisfy a father because at the best he does little more in his own home. But no woman who could be with her children would be content to merely see them. The permission to visit them might be an indulgence and relief in comparison of being utterly excluded, but it could never be held to be the same thing as living with them.
So this bill did pass both houses in 1839. I know it's time for me to stop, so I will in just a second. She didn't get the kids then because he took them off to Scotland and the law didn't apply there. And it did take a tragedy before she did get custody in the fall of 1842 when her youngest son was 9. He fell from his pony, he got a scratch on his arm, it got infected, it was either lockjaw or blood poisoning. And he was very sick, her husband called her, but it was, by the time she got there, this little boy died. And it was after that that he gave her custody of the children.
Thanks very much, Mary. Our closing words were written by Charles Dickens. It won't do to have truth and justice on our side. We must have law and lawyers. Thanks for coming. Have some discussion about that afterwards. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you and join us for coffee and conversation.